House Health, Education, and Social Services Committee, and note that today is Monday, March 20th, 1989, and members present are Representatives Boyer, Jacko, Sherry Davis, and myself, Representative Ellis. I'd like to ask anyone who intends to testify this morning to make sure that you've signed in on the witness register at the back of the room. I note that Representative Furness has joined us. Good morning. We have one item, one piece of legislation on the calendar this morning. Before we begin the other part of our program that Representative Boyer will be chairing this morning, and that's Senate Bill 166, an act relating to conformance between actual payments and approved payment rates to health facilities for medical care under certain state medical assistance programs and providing for an effective date. I hope to handle that between now and 8:30 and then move on with the rest of this morning's program. I'd like to welcome the members of the Health Association of Alaska who are in town for a get-together here. We're glad to have you with us. And maybe before we begin, just so we'll know who all is here, if you guys could just state your name and which facility you're with, your affiliation, and then we'll get on with the bill. Can we start here with Emmett on this side?
I'm with the Humana Hospital. Emmett Wilson, I believe it'll be a later.
Sharon Anderson from Humana.
Rick White from Humana.
Carl Scott, Humana.
In the back row there?
I'm Tom Bowling, the Department of Sisters of Providence, the Lady of Compassion.
Sister Donna Taylor, Providence Hospital Anchorage, Administrator.
Bob Ogden, Administrator, Mary Conrad Center.
Ed Lesky, Administrator, Sitka Community Hospital, Sitka.
Dave Hennigan, Providence Hospital, in Anchorage.
Stephen Rose, I'm an attorney representing Sitka and Humana.
Jim Gingrich, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital Administrator.
I'm Sandra Sykes, and I'm down here with the Vision Committee.
Okay. Harlan Knudsen with the Health Association.
Dave Ford with Blue Cross, Steve Clark with us.
Good morning. We're glad to have you all with us this morning. Let's begin with Senate Bill 166. Then I understand that Commissioner Myra Munson is with us by way of teleconference from the Fairbanks site. We'll let the Commissioner go ahead and present the legislation and the administration's position, and then we'll take further testimony and consideration of the bill. Good morning, Commissioner. If you'd like to, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Myra Munson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. I'll start by stating the administration's position on the bill and then try to briefly explain what the bill does and how it arose. The administration's position is that we're neutral on this. We neither oppose nor support the bill, provided it is adopted under certain conditions. The need for the bill from the perspective of facilities that were affected arose as a result of a perfectly legitimate action of the Medicaid Rate Commission in August of 1988, when they repealed their authority to waive a part of the methodology for rate setting called urine conformance. They waived that, or they repealed that provision for waiver in order to have a tighter system in which there would be fewer requests coming to them and therefore fewer opportunities for them to succumb to the temptation to allow costs to go up. The intention of urine conformance is to hold costs, hold the growth in the amount paid from year to year by a set of mathematical adjustments, and the intention of it is to encourage the best managed facilities possible within a quality care system. The prospective rate setting system that the Medicaid Rate Commission had adopted is a very new system in this state, and when they repealed their authority to waive the urine conformance, they had not had a lot of experience with how urine conformance would actually work and whether it would in fact do what they had expected or would have some unanticipated consequences. The first two facilities that came up for consideration with for new rates and had the urine conformance applied proved that, in fact, the urine conformance had some unanticipated consequences. And so for particularly two facilities initially, Humana and Sitka, each of which had taken a perfectly reasonable step. In Humana's case, they had cared for some children with Medicaid authorization approval for an extended period of time, much longer than the ordinary admission. And in Sitka's case, if I understand correctly, they had tried to raise their charges to more accurately reflect the actual cost of doing business, which led to an abrupt rise in charges, a shift in the ratio of cost to charges, In both cases, when the Urine Conformance Mathematical Computations went into effect, it reduced the payment authorized for the coming year for the fiscal year 89 year for these facilities, which in both cases began September 1st, dramatically lower. In both cases, the Rate Commission, upon initial consideration, looked at that and said, this isn't what we wanted to have happen. The Rate Commission took steps in December to modify this by adopting a new regulation which allows waiver under limited circumstances, manifest injustice and irreparable harm. The difficulty is that that left these facilities and other facilities with a year in conformance in the position of their being able to have no retroactive impact, and this new regulation would not go into effect until March 25th, which means that to the extent that the facilities are being paid less than they would have been had the commission had authority to waive year in conformance, which is almost certainly true in the case of Humana and Sitka, and may be true in the case of at least one other facility or two, the commission, and now the Department of Control Rate Setting, can't do anything about that retroactively. And therein came the decision on the part of the Senate Health Committee to introduce this bill. The period that the facilities are affected began in September. Under the Medicaid, under the, our contract with the federal authorities, the Healthcare Financing Agency, we cannot take actions which have retroactive effect. There's nothing that can be done either legislatively or through regulation to remedy this situation for the period from September 1st through January 1st. In the period from January 1st through March 31st, there's at least an argument to be made with the federal government that if this legislation is adopted and our state plan amendment is submitted, postmarked, prior to March 31st, that the federal government would participate in the compensation, the additional compensation that might be paid to these facilities, with the department now having the authority to waive the year in conformance during that period. We can't be positive that they will accept the state plan amendment, but we have at least a straight-faced argument that they ought to. Fundamentally, the question facing the legislature, and the reason the department's position on this is neutral, is whether the legislature should take action to remedy the consequences of the outcome of an unanticipated consequence of an independent commission, because that's literally what happened here. There was no testimony to the opposing the repeal of the year in conformance waiver. The commission took steps as quickly as it discovered that it had consequences they had not anticipated to give themselves more flexibility, and ultimately the department now is the rate setter, more flexibility with regard to year in conformance. It simply left this window in which everyone effectively is innocent. There are fiscal consequences to it. In light of the budget situation, the administration is neutral on the bill, provided it is adopted prior to March 31st. If it's not, if the legislation were adopted after March 31st, I would recommend veto, because it would not be possible to put it in place without violating the Medicaid conditions of our state plan. Thank you. I'm available for questions if committee members have them.
Commissioner, thank you for your presentation and making an effort to be with us this morning. Are there questions? I have a couple, Commissioner. You were talking about recommending veto if we don't get this done and by the end of this month. What are the sanctions if we were to try and go ahead after that date and we're in violation of our, we got in trouble with the federal Medicaid program? What would be potential sanctions against us?
The potential sanctions range from, certainly it would mean no participation, which would mean the fiscal note would double in value from half state funds and half federal funds to being all state funds. And more seriously, it could cause the Healthcare Financing Agency to reject our Medicaid plan in total for simply being out of compliance with the basic conditions that we pay only according to an approved state plan. So it could have the consequence of losing our Medicaid participation in all facility costs.
And it's Humana and Sitka hospitals that we've heard from on this issue, and that you mentioned that other facilities may have been impacted. Why is it that we don't know that now? Is it people haven't realized that they're impacted, or?
Mr. Chairman, Karen, what happened here is that the two facilities had their rates set and had the commission consider what had happened, why their rates dropped so dramatically, so that we have a good record to suggest that if this bill became law, in fact, the department, even as a rate setter, would find, or the commission would find, the advisory commission now would recommend a waiver under the conditions for Humana and Sitka, because in both cases, they've already acted on it. In the case, the other two facilities affected, as far as we can tell, are two January 1st facilities, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and Wrangell Hospital. In the case of Fairbanks and Wrangell, there has been a significant decrease in the percent of charges that will be authorized in the fiscal year 89 payment structure, but in neither case has there been either an appeal by the facility or action by the commission, considering whether that year in conformance is in fact exactly what was anticipated to occur when the year in conformance regulations were put into effect, or whether in fact it was one more instance of an unanticipated consequence, a facility managing well, acting responsibly, providing the care it's supposed to, and because of the way the mathematics work, there was this sudden drop. So the reason that we're unable to say whether the two facilities would also be included is simply because there's been no consideration of whether they would meet the standard of manifest injustice for during that period.
Representative Jacko has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, we have two fiscal notes in this packet here. One is for 100 or 250, and the other one is for 583. And in the first one, the federal funds are 50%, and in the other one, the federal funds look like they represent about 20% or something like that. I was wondering if you could tell us why there's two fiscal notes here and which one are we to go by.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jacko, I think the $583,000 fiscal note was on Senate Bill 166. The second fiscal note for $250,000 is on committee substitute for Senate Bill 166. And I believe that is a 50-50. 125 general fund match and 125 general fund match and 125 federal funds. I don't have the fiscal note in front of me. If that's the correct one, there's also an addendum to it, and the correct addendum is the one that reads revised addendum to fiscal note for committee substitute for Senate Bill 166, and that says that if Fairbanks Memorial were to be granted a waiver, we would anticipate the impact to be an additional $250,000 with 125 state general funds, general fund match, and 125 federal funds. But I'm sorry, I don't have the fiscal notes in front of me, so I can't be positive on answering your question.
Great. I guess one more little question here on the one that says committee substitute, the date is on the 6th, and on the Senate bill, the date is on the 9th, so you got the committee substitute before you got the other one there. I wonder how that happened.
It happened because when we looked at the original bill, we immediately informed the committee that the original bill would have to be opposed as written. It was it reflected from the drafter's part a significant lack of information, basically, about how the rate-setting process works, not surprising since it's an extremely technical area of practice. We recommended, in trying to cooperate with the committee, although the position of the department was neutral, we helped them draft a bill which would be technically correct, and at the request of the committee did not submit a fiscal note on the original bill. After the committee substitute went in and we submitted a fiscal note for that, a bill that at least is technically correct, we were then asked by committee staff, we were told that there had to be a fiscal note attached to every version of the bill, and we were asked to create a fiscal note for the original bill, and so we did.
Commissioner, thank you for clearing that up. I'm sure that would come up, will come up again, and we'll have to educate people as to why that occurred. Mm-hmm. I hope you can stay with us throughout our deliberations here. We, because of the time frame involved, I do intend to take final action on this bill this morning. So the next witness we'll call is Sharon Anderson. Sharon, if you'd like to join us at the table, please, and then Ed Maluski will follow Ms. Anderson. If you could state your full name for the record and your affiliation, and then please go ahead. We will have to keep presentations pretty succinct this morning because of our time.
Sharon Anderson from Humana Hospital Alaska in Anchorage. I'm here today to speak in favor of the bill and also to thank Commissioner Munson for her cooperative efforts in drafting the committee substitute for the bill that would allow the state to remain in federal compliance with regard to the Medicaid application setting of the rates. As was stated, the regulation that this bill corrects was repealed by the Medicaid Rate Commission on or about July 20th of 1988. On August 5th, Humana went back to the Rate Commission for the establishment of our fiscal year 89 Medicaid rate, and it was at that time, just the 2 weeks later, that they realized that the change in the regulation or the repeal of the regulation had not only an unanticipated result but an undesirable outcome that resulted in an unreasonable rate that was set for Humana. In our instance, it was set at 34%. In our particular situation, it was the result of caring for six Medicaid individuals, all of whom were certified by the PRO, which is the professional review organization that the state contracts with for medical necessity, for admission, and continued stay review. They had very, very long lengths of stay, an average of 93 days, and of course the hospital costs were such that it from the year in conformance standpoint, resulted in an adjusted cost per hospital stay that exceeded a particular dollar amount, and thus the year in conformance when applied, even though those patients were reviewed for medical necessity and continued stay review, thus the unanticipated and undesirable outcome. This legislation would correct that. The repeal of the regulation was indeed put back on the books by the Medicaid Rate Commission as quickly as they could, as stated by the commissioner in December, but for Sitka and Humana at that time and now the other two facilities that were mentioned, this bill will help to correct that situation back before the Medicaid Rate Commission.
Ms. Anderson, thank you. Are there any questions for the witness? Representative Jacko?
Probably not for the witness, maybe for the commissioner. I was wondering if there may be other facilities that would need this change also, other than the ones that you've named.
To date, from what I understand, and the commissioner can correct me, the regulation is proposed to be back in effect April 1st after having been sent to the Lieutenant Governor's office for the 30-day time frame. Those facilities that have come up for the rate review would be just from that window period of August through to date. And the Medicaid Rate Commission will meet again tomorrow, although they will not be considering any facility rates. And then the next time that they'll meet, I believe, is April 17th. So it's just this window period that the facilities that were kind of caught in it are not able to be corrected.
Ms. Anderson, thank you very much. Mr. Maluski, could you join us, please? Morning.
Good morning. My name is Ed Maluski. I represent Sitka Community Hospital. I'm the administrator there. Thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity. I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 166. We were inadvertent victims of changes in of the year-end conformance in that the hospital is approximately 6 years old. The first 3 years, there had been no changes within the hospital for a variety of reasons to make it usage within the community more palatable and things like that. At the end of the 3 years, they were ready to go down the tubes financially, and if they didn't do something very quickly, they would have been an untenable position and not be able to provide any care, let alone quality care. Because of the changes were made at that particular time, since no changes affected were made with 3 years, they did affect the year-end conformance for us. Because of the statistical nature of the year-end conformance, our rate was then established at 20%. I'm not sure that was brought out before this group. And that's, I want to emphasize that, 20%. You cannot provide any care, let alone quality care, at 20%. We appealed for a waiver of year-end conformance. The Medicaid Rate Commission did grant a waiver of our year-end conformance, and we were established at a rate at 70%+. This bill will help ensure that our rate for that particular time stays there, and we will not be forced back to the 20% rate. I'm available for questions.
Mr. Maluski, thank you very much. Are there questions? If not, thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
Are there any further witnesses on this item? Commissioner, do you have any other comments before we open it up to the committee discussion?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone around the table have any thoughts here on this item? Representative Boyer?
You ready for a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Well, let's give it another moment here to set. Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, you told us this was urgent, so we believe you.
Well, we do have until 8:30. I mean, we can sit here and ponder this for another 3.5 minutes. Just to put it on the record, the legislation does need to move today. It's scheduled in the Finance Committee, pending referral from this committee, and then on to the Rules Committee under the floor. And I'm hoping that we can get this taken care of before the Easter weekend. So, coming to our deadline. I guess if there is no further discussion, we placed on the record the rationale behind the drafting of the legislation, the reason it's needed, and the reason it needs to pass in a timely fashion. So I will, at this time, entertain a motion. Representative Boyer.
I would move we pass out CS for Senate Bill 166 with individual recommendations with the 3689
which is the correct version. Is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any objection? No objection to order. Without action taken and item set aside, we'll move into our program this morning. I'd like to turn the conduct of the meeting over to Representative Boyer, who I believe has some opening remarks, and then we'll begin our dialogue with the people present today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are starting 3 days of kind of focused hearings on the cost of providing health care in the state of Alaska and also cost containment efforts, which we might be entertaining in the state of Alaska. And we structured the 3 days of hearings to provide for today's focus to be that on facilities, long-term care facilities and hospitals generally, and also to have with us a presentation of community-based approach to cost containment efforts that are actually being looked at here in the state of Alaska in the community of Seward. Tomorrow, we are going to focus on insurance, and glad to see folks here from Blue Cross who are going to make a presentation tomorrow, but focus more of our attention on the insurance side of cost containment efforts that might be made in the state, and also have a presentation by the Commissioner of Health and Social Services on what the state is doing to contain the cost of care in the state. And then finally, on Wednesday, we're going to have a delegation of Canadians who are in town for other business who are also going to make a presentation to the committee on what the folks in the Yukon Territory have done and what Canada generally does or has been doing to contain their increases in the cost of care. That's kind of just a general overview. The chairman and I were both members of the Governor's Health Care Commission over the last year, and we took a broad look at health care in the state of Alaska and recognize fully that there are some needs that we can, where there are needs in the whole area of cost containment that need to be addressed in the state. And so we thought it was important that we had a general discussion here around the table. And with that, I think what I do is call Harlan up, and you may want to make some introductions, but essentially the morning is yours. I know that you have some folks with you lined up to make a presentation.
Good. And before Harlan begins, I'd like to note that Representative Max Greenberg has joined the committee. Good morning, Harlan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Max. I'm Harlan Nuds, and I'm the Executive Director of the Health Association of Alaska, representing hospitals and nursing homes. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, first, thank you. Certainly one of the buzzwords around this capital, this legislative session, is the cost of health care. And we really look forward to the opportunity to sit down with you this morning and just talk about hospital costs and talk about nursing home costs. What drives them? What makes them where they're at? We want to continue to put emphasis on the Governor's Interim Commission Report and what it's saying about the cost of health care. This is a valuable document. We don't want to lose track of it. So I kind of want the committee, if you will, to lean back and get a fresh cup of coffee, and you're going to meet with a couple of real nice administrators, Jim Gingrich, who is the administrator for Fairbanks Memorial, Dennis Murray, who is the administrator of Heritage Place Nursing Home down in Soldotna. They're going to just give you a little bit of their world when they look at setting their budgets and setting their reimbursement rates. And then we're going to bring on Dr. Bruce Amundson. And Dr. Amundson is going to just share a good idea with you that perhaps there are some options, perhaps there are some solutions to making health care available to all our citizens in the state. So I'd like to bring Jim and Dennis up and have them visit with you for half an hour or so on health care costs. Did we lose Dennis? Watch Dennis, he's quick.
When we speak, this will have to be about 6 inches from the one here on the other end.
I think I'll try to keep my opening remarks somewhat short, but would be available to later in the meeting, because I know we're limited to 1 hour and a half. Total. Okay. I'll only take an hour. I'm Jim Gingrich, the administrator at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, and also serve as the chairman of the Health Association of Alaska. We too, as an industry, representing the kind of viewpoint of acute care, are and have been very concerned about the rising health care costs. As an association, we've been studying this quite thoroughly in working with the Interim Commission. And at the same time, we've been taking an in-depth look at it, at the whole issue nationwide. And some of the facts that come to the forefront is since 1951, there's only been 5 years during that period of time in which health care costs have not exceeded the inflation rate. As a nationwide trend. Some of the early research shows that in the early 50s, when inflation wasn't too much of a factor, when it was only 1%, health care would be 1.3%. As we moved into the 70s and 80s, that became more pronounced. And then when we got into the late 70s and late 80s, when we got into double-digit inflation, health care costs still exceeded the inflation rates nationwide. It was happening in Alaska also, and it was happening at a somewhat higher rate in Alaska, primarily due to the expansion and access to services in the state. As the economy slowed down in the mid-80s, 83 through 85, 87, healthcare costs continued to escalate much higher than the inflation factor. Some of that's due to the way the state has developed and the access to care around the state. There are several factors that make this issue kind of pronounced in Alaska. The freestanding acute care hospitals are located in a number of locations. But if you start out with Providence Hospital with 337 beds, then it's followed by Humana Hospital with 238 beds, and Fairbanks Memorial with 181 beds. Guess what? You now have 80% of the beds in the state in those three hospitals. And also 80% of the costs of health care, acute inpatient care, happens in only three facilities. So the point there is, as one works with averages and tries to figure average cost of a stay in the hospital in some community in Alaska, averages don't count for much because we're comparing apples to oranges. And I think as explanations come about, a lot of times we kind of forget the economies of scale that happen in this state. When 80% of your beds are located in three hospitals, and then you take a look at a community like Valley Hospital, that's 34 beds, Seward Hospital, 33 beds, Sitka Hospital, 24 beds, or Valdez, 15 beds. And with Valdez running an average patient a load of four patients, there are no economies of scale. So when we see that the
healthcare costs continue to escalate, we cannot overlook those factors. Doesn't provide necessarily an acceptable excuse, except that they are very much factors. The purpose of the hearing is to kind of talk about why the high costs, and then what cost containment measures are there now, and what further cost containment measures can be explored. We already know that because of the remote locations and the economies of scale, that's a major cost factor. Why are they high? Recruiting people, agency nurses, shortage of healthcare professionals, trained technical people. This type of service requires those technical people. What cost containment are being practiced and what ones will probably be practiced much more closely in the future? Some of them will be recruiting efforts, trying to recruit multi-trained people in the community so that maybe a x-ray tech could be cross-trained with a lab tech, those types of things. It's one of the cost containment efforts that is available to some of the smaller communities. It's even available to a community like us, is to try to find people who have multiple skills. That could pay off as a possible cost containment method. In Alaska, we pay for a lot of relocation. There are some military issues in the state, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kodiak, are communities that depend heavily upon military-trained people. They don't have really a healthcare shortage of professionals in some of those communities. Kodiak is an example. They have a Coast Guard base, and they usually have a pretty good access to RNs, where a lot of communities have extreme problems in recruiting RNs. But that's not without a problem, because you then have a lot of turnover and you have a lot of retraining time and that type of thing. But sometimes you do have lower labor costs by having access to the military people. Diagnosis in the smaller facilities. There is good health care being offered in many of the small facilities. At the same time, this state experiences a lot of double diagnosis costs. If you have a patient that can't be treated in one of the smaller facilities, when I say smaller, Fairbanks can be considered as a smaller. If you have certain services, certain heart procedures, certain medical procedures that they don't offer, then we refer to Anchorage. But the diagnosis costs almost double, because you spend time working up a patient. That's why some of the healthcare costs are higher. Some of the remote communities, it's true also. You double diagnose a patient. You treat them, you do studies, you do x-rays, you do lab work, and then you say, I think I better refer them to a specialist. Many times they can be treated in those local communities. But then there's a double bill. When you go to Humana or Providence, many of those doctors repeat many of those same tests. So the referral pattern causes a lot of that. Cost containment, what's being done? Many of the communities are updating technology. They're trying to get more physicians in the community that can offer a wider variety of services so that you can get away from some of that double diagnosis expense. Risk management is one of the single biggest issues about cost. Liability costs for all healthcare providers has simply gone through the roof in the last 3 to 5 years. An example specific to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, but not unlike most other facilities, the liability cost of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital 3 years ago was about $328,000. Last year, our premium was $528,000. Now, the liability coverage to cover all your employees, types of things that you do in your hospital. This year at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, our liability premium is $1,500,000. It increased $1 million. Tort reform has been and is before you at this legislative session. The Health Association knows that single Act can do more in the long term for cost containment than probably any other single factor. other things that we're doing in the healthcare setting, the acute care setting, to assist with cost containment is home health care programs. Communities have taken on the responsibility of developing home health care programs, taking people out of the expensive inpatient care facilities and discharging them to the appropriate other facilities. It might be long-term care for a short stay, or it might be to a home under the direction of a home health care nurse. So those are home and community-based programs are expanding every day. In the lower 48, those were already in place, and there were a number of options for people not needing acute care. In this state, because of its relatively new development of an acute care system, those systems simply haven't been in place, and they are now coming into place. So those are some of the overview of some of the key issues and some of the cost containment programs that are underway to address the escalating costs. I think one of the biggest issues is to be aware that the inflation rate it's not an issue that's unique to Alaska, and it isn't that we shouldn't be alarmed about it, but you pick up the paper every day, and whether it's USA Today or Anchorage paper or any national newspaper, and you'll find an article someplace in there on the high costs of health care. This one came out of USA Today last week, which showed that the average employer in the United States, what their health care costs have gone up. And that's primarily due to acute care, but it's also due to dental visits. It's a professional component. People a lot of times label the true health care cost as just staying in a hospital. You tend to think if you're sick, hospital, but there's a lot of components to that. For companies that had 10,000 or more workers, they can count on a 19% or a 20% cost increase nationwide. 5,000 workers, 20% also. 1,000 to 5,000 workers, 21%. Only if you have employees of less than 1,000, then it dropped to 15%. Now that's at the same time that inflation rate nationwide is somewhere between 3 and 6%, depends on how people describe it.
Tim, before you go on, let me place on the record that Representative Peter Gull joined the committee several minutes ago.
As an association and as acute care facilities, we've spent a lot of time studying. We did a cost study, which was simply just launching the task of identifying costs and trying to study the components of those costs. And as an association, we're doing a lot more work in that area. At the same time, we do support a lot of the findings in the commission report. And as an association, we plan to continue to pursue many of the recommendations in this report on cost containment, ways to provide access to people to health care in the state without using so much acute care in the process. And those are primarily trying to expand community-based programs. So that's kind of an overview of the acute care issues. I could expand on any of them, but in order to have time for the other people, then I'd be available for questions later. Okay?
Jim, thank you very much. I think we'll hold questions then. Members could do that. Let's move on with Dennis's presentation.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jim said quite a bit, and I won't just highlight some of the points that he made are also points in terms of nursing homes and long-term care. For example, there are 5 freestanding nursing facilities in the state, which represent, again, the majority of the beds in the state for nursing care in the private sector, at least as we describe it. And the remaining beds are in co-located facilities, meaning facilities that are community-based hospitals that have both acute care sections and long-term care sections. So some of the points that Jim made as to economies of scale relate the same to long-term care as they do to acute care. I think one of the things I would like to say is that there's been a great deal of discussion about the fact that costs are out of control. And the Health Association and certainly the long-term care administrators don't believe that's the case. I understand the commissioner is on, and she may want to comment about this, but for example, the largest facility in the state is Our Lady of Compassion in Anchorage. They have 220 beds, which is fully one-third of, at least in the private sector, the nursing beds in the state. Their costs between 1984 and 1988 rose 4%. That's hardly cost their daily rate of costs to the Medicaid program for recipients served. That's hardly could be characterized as out of control. And again, they're the largest facility in the state. What I wanted to do was share with you what are some of the reasons for the costs, and to put it on somewhat of an individualized basis, I just, using my facility as example, would like to share some data with you. I know you get a lot of this stuff, but sometimes the graphics helps you understand the dynamics of it. Heritage Place is one of the smaller facilities. We have a total of 45 beds. And I'm sharing with you our expenses from January 1989, and just to show you where our costs are. And when we speak about cost containment, you have to put it in that context. Fully, for our facility, 50% of our costs are salary and benefits to our employees. In our particular case, we're a privately financed facility. It was not a grant that built the building. So a very high expense for us, and one that is not controllable by us at this point in time, is the interest cost on the long-term debt. And that's, we were sharing this information with one of the staff assistants to the committee, and they thought that $28,000 was per year. That's for the month of January. And it's based on the fact of our construction cost at about $3.5 million, and if you just compare it to your own home loan on your own personal home, well, just multiply it by what you're paying by what we're paying. It's not an unusual number when you consider it in that light. Depreciation for us, again, a new facility, depreciation of assets of both equipment and the building is a fairly large slice of our pie on this pie chart. So those two items alone for the facility which I operate are fully 30% of our costs per day. And the fact of our occupancy at being at 30 residents today, we have to spread the cost of our doing business over that occupancy. And so that drives the cost too. If we were at 45 fully occupied beds, certainly we could divide 45 into 28,000 and not 30 into 28,000. And so that's one of the issues that certainly is for us. Salary and benefits are probably the one area that facilities have some control, and yet not a great deal of control. We have to comply with standards that are set by both the federal and state government. For example, in my facility, I'm a skilled facility. The state of Alaska requires that we staff 24-hour-a-day registered nurses, and that that means that we have to recruit those nurses, and we have to pay them salaries commensurate with the competition and everything else. Interestingly enough, most states and in fact Medicare, which is the payer, a payer of skilled care, not the primary payer in long-term care at least, do not require RNs. So we in the state have a higher standard, and I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't have that higher standard. I'm only pointing out that when we look at cost containment, we have to look at it in the context of what we're doing, and clearly that and several of the administrators are here today. But we really, our ability to swing in terms of changing the costs is not that great. I gave you some information the next pages as to some comparative statistics between what we're currently paying for staff at Heritage Place what the state of Alaska is to show you, hopefully that comparison. And I tried to base this on a recent state study of the Division of Personnel, and I'm sure that we could there could be some argument as to my choices, but I hope that the choices were good. A long story short, we are currently at 70% of paying our employees as to what the state is paying the employees for the same jobs. So if the only place I have to go to contain costs is salary and benefits, what number should we use, 50%, 40%? There's certainly been a great deal of argument in the state over the fact of comparing long-term care costs with the lower 48 costs in terms of long-term care. And what's important there is that nursing facilities are very much dependent upon entry-level positions, nurses' aides, cooks, housekeepers. And we simply have in the state a higher threshold for payment for those positions than they have in other states. And that drives our costs. That's what puts us a great deal higher when you compare costs between, for example, the state of North Dakota and Alaska. And it is because I am paying, as it points out here, I'm paying for a nurse's aide resident assistant $8.30 an hour to start. Where would the committee members suggest I start that person? Because that's the largest group of people that work for me, are the resident assistants. And I know you want to hear solutions and not problems, but the problems are not going away, and the solutions are not getting any closer, in my judgment, given some of the dynamics. But I hope the information is helpful, and again, I would just say that what Mr. Gingrich has shared, the costs are similar, and what are we doing? Well, many facilities have tried to conserve resources, change the way they do business, reduce the costs. Gary Grandy, one of the administrators here, indicated to me yesterday that his cost in 1989 for the total operation of facility is less than it was in 1985. So clearly his community and his mission has been to control costs. So the costs are not out of control in his particular facility, at least by that measure, I would submit. What are some of the things that can be done? I think some of the things you are currently doing, certainly to HB 10, which the chairman is a sponsor of, to provide forgiveness for nurses for student loans, is a step in the right direction. We've got to increase the labor pool and encourage young women and middle-aged women and men and whomever to get into nursing to correct the problems we're experiencing with the shortages. And I was at a meeting this morning, and the point was made that should we also include LPNs, because some facilities are experiencing shortages with LPNs. So I guess I would just submit to the chair that you might look at that, expanding the bill to encompass LPNs, because they're needed too. Tort reform, Jim has already mentioned, and I would just share with the committee, one of our other facilities has put together a graph, which I think illustrates the problem very very graphically. I'm speaking of St. Anne's Nursing facility in Juneau. Jack Buck was not able to be with us this morning, but here's his experience of St. Anne's in a five-year period of the cost of workman's compensation insurance and malpractice insurance. His malpractice insurance in fiscal 84 was $21,837. In fiscal 88, it is $108,164. His workman's compensation was $27,932 in 1984. In 1988, it was $77,913. Those are largely uncontrollable costs on a facility basis. I won't say they're totally uncontrollable, because certainly there are practices that management can employ to reduce the number of claims and to provide ample training for its employees. But particularly nursing facilities have a higher incidence of workman's comp, as an example, than almost in many other industries, because of the nature of lifting and transferring people. That's the business we're in, and that business has the potential for injury. And therefore, that's reflective, I guess, to some extent, as to why the cost has gone up the extent it has. I would just close and welcome questions from the committee.
Thanks, Dennis. Are there questions? I have one question on your wages. On your wages, there wondering if are your wages average in the industry, or are they on a low end?
I would say that our wages would be average for the industry, for the private sector.
I just make a note here. Last night I met with Dennis and Jim and a number of other people, and we talked about unionization too in the area in this area, and how the state then continues to drive costs. Maybe we could have that discussion too, or on the table, so there's some appreciation of that.
That's has surfaced very much an issue in the last 8 months, and just to give you a synopsis of that, unionization first started, I think, in Kodiak a couple years ago. Right at this point in time, they're represented by the Teamsters, and they're in the process of the final negotiations of a contract. Now, when they negotiate contract, the standard that they look for is, naturally, where's another labor source that's our biggest competitor that has better wages and benefits? That is state employees, without any doubt, whether it's benefits or whether it's base salaries. This last summer, Valley Hospital went union by an overwhelming vote, and they're represented by IBEW. Homer Hospital went union this past summer with the Teamsters. Both of those facilities are currently in labor negotiations. The issues that face them is the state employee salaries and benefits is what they're trying to bring their employees up to. Last week, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital received a petition from the National Labor Relations Board. We'll have an election in May to be represented by IBEW. Last week, Humana Hospital received a petition from the National Labor Relations Board for an election in their facility. Mike Lockwood in Soldotna had a petition 3 or 4 weeks ago that was improperly filed, and that's back to the drawing board. What's before us is complete unionization of the hospital industry. As I pointed out to Mark and some Fairbanks legislators last night, health care in this state, if you take Lutheran Hospital and Home facilities and add Providence Hospital facilities, we now employ a group that's larger than any other private employer. When you add Humana and all the other health care, we are the single largest employers in the state. And with unionization, I can assure you that the purpose of unionization is to not figure out ways to decrease costs. So, cost containment. We're going to fight the unionization attempt very vigorously. And if we win, then we will have made a major step toward cost containment. If we lose, and then we now have Kodiak, Homer, Valley, Fairbanks, Humana, Providence is right behind. Because when they read those contracts that are settled out in those communities, why wouldn't they sign right up? So it's a real crisis coming down the pike. And it's being driven by basically state employee salaries and wages.
Any other comments, questions?
Jim, you mentioned in your presentation home health, and that was a major recommendation of the governor's health commission to explore options in that area. Conventional wisdom among a lot of people is that would be a major cost savings. I think the governor's commission approached in-home services and more community-based services as alternatives or choice for people to avoid institutionalization and inappropriate levels of care for them, and sort of expand the range of options available to people that are in need of some sort of care. What kind of scale or what kind of numbers do you have to achieve in a program, or what are the things, elements needed to achieve a certain economy of scale where in-home health services actually, in addition to a better quality maybe of service, or not necessarily quality, but a more appropriate level of care, achieved for the person in the program, when do you actually see cost savings?
I think when you, immediately, whenever you discharge a person early and send them home to a home health care program, you save money from an acute care stay. The point in which a facility or a community can get started with a home health care program is kind of an issue. I know when I was administrator of Kodiak, we did a lot of studies on that. We just couldn't substantiate a home health care program. I think they're relooking at that. That's in a community of about 13,000, but because a lot of that depends on elderly people, you simply don't have the volume. And then the startup costs. Someone has to come up with the startup costs, and that's not inexpensive either.
Could I comment on it, Mr. Chairman? I think the commission did put together some good ideas. I think one of the real problems, I know you have a housing study that's being distributed or being finalized right now, and I would just share with you, in my community, and the community of both Soldotna and Kenai and Sterling and the whole Central Peninsula, we have currently one foster care home licensed who accepts adult. And so I raised the question, where if I'm to be doing discharge planning, and I do, that's my requirement, where do I send the person? There is a problem, and it is to some degree economies of scale. But foster care is individualized. When you're speaking home health, that I think is something different. But we also have a real problem in that with the housing, it's assumed that that's taken care of that niche of the need for the elderly people. And the problem is that if I want to look at discharge planning with a resident, that resident goes on a waiting list. It may be as long as my arm. And they're at the bottom of that waiting list. There is no prioritization for independent HUD-sponsored housing for those persons who are currently in institutions or potentially to be institutionalized. So that person waits, and that's a cost containment issue. If we don't put that person up high on the list, if that person doesn't get the next available apartment, then they will not be able to be appropriately deinstitutionalized, because there are no alternatives. They can't go back to their home, but they could go into a sheltered housing with appropriate home health care services. But they're on a waiting list, and they're at the bottom.
Representative Gall.
Do you find that people who are subject to discharge are finding that they can't move into this HUD housing because some of it has been reallocated for other purposes, and there's just a shortage of space for that reason as well?
I don't believe that's the experience on the peninsula. It may be in other areas, but no, that's not a concern. However, I will say I think one of our facilities that was built in Nanilchik, because they couldn't find people, but again, that's a question of location. If you're trying to discharge a person who may have some real support needs, you have to put them into a place that they can get that support services. I'm only suggesting the Nilchik doesn't have, in some ways, a sufficient support system. So it's difficult, and they're having to open up their facility to non-disabled senior population.
Representative Jacko.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess sitting here listening to you guys, I'm trying to justify why your costs are continually increasing. And I can understand nationwide why the costs are increasing. Of course, the population in the whole nation is increasing. But here in Alaska, our population really isn't increasing. And so it seems like you guys are actually delivering less care to less people. And I can understand when you say that economies of scale have something to do with this, and the other reasons that you've cited sound like they all apply to reasons why our costs would be high in the first place. But it doesn't really explain why the costs continually increase when you guys are, it would seem to be, giving less and less care to less and less people. So I guess I'm just having a little bit of a hard time accepting the fact that your costs are not out of control.
Touch that one? Oh, my goodness.
Jim, would you care to respond?
This study here, which I could get you a copy of, one of the key factors in Alaska is the capital costs that are out there in many of these facilities. And if you have one component which now cannot be changed, it's the capital costs. And so to keep the facilities up and running, the fixed costs, or the adjustable costs, wages and salaries, and those types of things, have in fact been managed quite well. And you have to kind of study this cost report to find that. But now the capital costs of putting these facilities in all of these locations are now, they're locked in. I know that doesn't...
Well, you know, that would explain why your costs could be maintained at a certain level, but it doesn't really explain why they could keep on increasing, you know, like more than the cost of inflation. So that's what I'm saying.
One example. Fairbanks Memorial Hospital in 1983 had 44,000 patient days, and it employed about 700 people. This year, we will have 20,000 patient days. So if you were running a car dealership, you sold 44,000 cars in 1983, and this year you sell only 20,000. We now have 430 employees to offer the baseline services. So the economies of scale in offering that same range of services to 20,000 patient days versus 40,000 simply isn't there. Now, you get into prioritizing services. Can you drop off specialties? That will be our next cost control measure, would be to say Fairbanks should not offer neonatal care, so that whenever you have a baby that needs neonatal care, it will automatically be transferred to Anchorage as opposed to being offered there. So then you have to then say, all right, what other services are you offering? We have 8 beds of intensive care. We used to have 12 beds. Now, we could close down the entire unit and transfer all intensive care patients to Anchorage, and probably in the big picture of things, contain costs even more. But because we keep those services open and the communities have gotten used to them, That's why those escalating costs are there. And it's true all over the state. I might not be...
Representative Bell, do you have a question?
Why has the traffic decreased so greatly in your facility?
It's kind of ironic because it's cost containment. Discharge planning, you get them out of the hospital quicker. To kind of go back and reiterate, probably the single biggest factor, uncompensated care, and I had that written in my presentation earlier. I don't have the numbers before me for specifically for Humana and Providence, but I do have them for Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. In 1979, the uncompensated care for Fairbanks Memorial Hospital was 700,000. During the peak time in 1983, when we had 44,000 patient days, our uncompensated care was 2 million. Last year, when we finished December, our uncompensated care was 5 million.
I don't understand how that relates.
That it gets back to the escalating costs. That doesn't mean the cost isn't there when you're not compensated. You have a non-paying person. That cost has to be passed along to someone in inflated costs.
Okay, I'm sorry. My question was, why has the number of patient days dropped? You know, is there a relationship between that and the uncompensated care?
Oh, okay. Well, I kind of switched back to Jacko's. Okay.
Well, I'd like to pursue the uncompensated care also, but first...
The patient days have dropped because we have gone to a lot more outpatient surgeries, so the admit doesn't need to come into the hospital. So what used to be a 3-day hospital stay or a 4-day hospital stay, so they're not in the hospital nearly as long, so those patient days have dropped. The second thing is discharge planning and DRGs, diagnostic related groupings, where Medicare patients are admitted. PRO, you review them for the stay and decide whether the stay is completely appropriate, or if it's not appropriate, what care is needed, and then you discharge them to home health, to nursing home care, outpatient care, those types of things. That's why the patient days have decreased.
So are you saying that the number of potential admissions has remained the same, but unnecessary services are no longer being rendered, or are you saying that the number of potential patients has remained the same and inadequate services being delivered? I mean, it's not a change in medical philosophy.
It's a change in medical philosophy.
It is. That cuts admissions 50% in a couple of years.
Complete change.
Well, I would appreciate your professional opinion. Is this philosophy for the good or for the bad? I mean, either we've been over-admitting in the past or we're under-admitting today. I mean, one or the other must be preference.
Representative Davis?
Representative Gall, perhaps I can share a little personal experience that would relate to this, I'm sure, and that is that when I had my first child in 1963, it was expected that the average mother would stay in the hospital for at least 3 days, 4 days, possibly longer, depending on circumstances at home, et cetera, et cetera. Am I correct so far? When I had my last child, who will be 15 in a couple of weeks, you walked into the delivery room, you walked out of the delivery room, and you, in some cases, were home the next that afternoon or at least by the following day. It was a difference in philosophy as far as treating a mother rather than as a patient, an ill person, as a healthy person who just happened to be having a baby. And I didn't change, and the way I had babies didn't change, but the idea of health care and what it was supposed to involve changed, and I think that dramatically kind of illustrates what's happening.
I guess what I'm heading towards is still the same sort of question. When my mother had her two children, she was in the hospital for 5 days one time, 2 weeks another, and she had more serious procedures, I guess, and to some extent that had to do with changes in times, but it wasn't over a few-year period where patient days dropped to 50%. That's a very radical figure. It does bring to my mind the fact that the insurance company's exposure has been cut in half as well. And it would seem to me rather unfortunate that they can't manage to fit that into their actuaries if they raise your costs. I'll tell you, as I've said before, I think you're the victim of a conspiracy, and I don't think it's appropriate to have the hospital people, the doctors, the people delivering children, be used as a pawn in the game. But specifically, before I get on to insurance, I would like to ask you again, sure, this saves costs to the insurance companies and in some cases to the patients. What is it doing for medical care? Do you feel you have a better system with more, and if you can divorce it from your own economic situation, I'd really appreciate it. Is this better, that people are getting out so much quicker, that they're being admitted less frequently, or is this, as you say, part of cost containment, and is it backfiring by raising your per patient cost?
I think from
what... In other words, it's cost containment for the insurance companies, but it raises the cost for each individual patient.
I think research and literature is showing that the quality of care isn't being adversely affected by some of the trends of shorter hospital stays. There's some pros and cons to that, but...
You have to help me. Am I asking a question that isn't as straight a question as it seems to me? To me, either they were getting too much care before, they're getting too little care now. If there's been a change of philosophy and it's based on patient care, then it's the first answer. They were getting too much before. If it's based on economics, then maybe they're getting too little now. And I'm having trouble asking the question in a way that generates a simple answer. Maybe you can tell me why it's not a simple question.
I think in the case of OB, they were probably getting too much before. But it took society a number of years to prioritize their methodology. The literature is saying that these sicker, older patients, if they have appropriate other care to go to out there, research is showing that they're not necessarily adversely affected by some of these changes in trend. it's just hard for society to accept the fact that your grandmother or whatever doesn't stay in the hospital until she's well, as we define well.
I see.
And
I would think I would agree that giving a proper home environment, certain place, institutional care, can be a benefit. What about the cost of long-term care? What does a patient have to pay if you have an uninsured patient who has resources, comes to your facility? What is the cost per month?
Cost in my facility, yes. Specifically? Right now it's $255
a day. $255
a day.
So, what do you think society should do about that? How do you think it should be handled? I hear what has been said about insurance. I understand the costs of capital construction. I think insurance is something that has to be worked out in a comprehensive fashion and isn't going to occur overnight unless it's with very rigid laws to restrict the insurance companies. They have not demonstrated any quid pro quo on liability issues. I'm not confident that that's going to be a simple fix. Likewise with capital costs and likewise with the cost of labor. While I've got the floor, I'd like to encourage all of you that as you negotiate with labor unions, what I think is the key issue is the quality of patient care that results after negotiations. I will suffer along with the rest of society if the cost of care increases, but what I found through the experience of my family who were involved in hospital administration for about 100 years combined, that making sure that you have adequate protections to ensure and enforce quality of patient care, especially in lifting and handling people, is something that I'd like to see high on your agendas, if you don't mind my lobbying you back. What do you think we can do, though? I mean, the cost of labor is a fact, the cost of insurance is a fact, the cost of buildings are a fact, but society has got to find a way to cope with these costs and not imagine that an individual is going to be able to be responsible for costs like that. Do you have any recommendations, either in terms of legislation or philosophy, that you share?
Well, I think it is a crucial issue, and I would agree with you that we have to put in place changes in philosophy in terms of our expectations. I think when Medicare and Medicaid came into existence in 65, that if we look at what transpired is that before that time we didn't have that much institutional care. And as soon as we as the government agreed that we would assist people, and that's a form of Medicare, certainly is an insurance program, or in theory an insurance program, we began to attract more, the supply and the need grew, and et cetera. I think that you have to look at the housing questions. How is the whole mix of services delivered? I think that there has to be more individual responsibility on the part of elderly in terms of recognizing the potential and planning for it. In Alaska, we have some particular problems because we have, I would characterize, a two-tiered system. We have the private facilities, most of them in communities that are co-located hospitals and nursing facilities. We have the five freestanding, and we have a Pioneer Home system. And I think that we've got to look at that as a state in terms of state policy. And I know that may not be something easily looked at, but you're asking me candidly what's my opinion. And candidly, we have got to look at of what we're doing. I'll give you an example that's very close to mine because it happened to my facility this week. We had a client who was Medicaid eligible, but who had applied for the Pioneer Home system, and that client decided to go there, which is fine. But in applying that, the Pioneer Home system said, we are taking this client because they are destitute. And I asked them, I had another client who was not Medicaid eligible and who would never be Medicaid eligible, and they said, well, that person is not destitute. And frankly, I can't understand that logic.
Why was that person not Medicaid eligible?
Because their income from was over the Medicaid standard, which is $1,104 a month. And so they're barred, I suppose you could say, for the for the foreseeable future from being eligible for state and federal.
Pension or something like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so in the one hand, I'm left potentially with someone who may at some point in time be uncompensated care, which then I would cost shift that to whoever is willing to, the remaining payers, which is largely Medicaid, or try to, because I'm trying to deliver that person care and not being compensated. At the same time, a person for whom I was receiving compensation has gone into another system, which the cost to the state in my delivery system was approximately $30,000 to the state and another $30,000 to the federal government. Now is $50-some thousand in the state system. Is that logical? I would argue I can't find the logic.
I have a couple of questions on that, if I could proceed.
We're going to have to wrap up this section in about 5 minutes, too. Oh, we still have Mr. Amundson.
Okay. I just need to ask about, you mentioned the Pioneer Homes and uncompensated care, so just real briefly, do you have a recommendation, if you took all the facilities in the state that could assist in a long-term care situation and just plug them down on the table, how would you allocate them out? What would you change? Would you eliminate the Pioneer Homes as a concept to create some sort of a group with the rest of the long-term care facilities, or what would you do?
I don't think I have a five-minute answer to that.
Well, if you folks have recommendations, I'd be very, very grateful, because the issue of making it possible for a person to get sick without feeling that their children don't get to go to college or their daughter is going to become homeless tomorrow. I have citizens in my district who literally call me every week with precisely those sorts of descriptions. I've got a trailer and I'm making payments on a car, so as a result, I'm going to have to lose everything before my wife can get chemotherapy. Been working all my life. I'm 55 years old. I'm on unemployment insurance. I expect me to pay for health insurance. I've really got to find an answer to that, and or try to help all of us find an answer to that. The one issue that I'd like to see us get a handle on quickly, though, if we could, is what you said about facilities programs that are not necessarily working in sync with one another. And I don't have the answers, but if as a group you come up with recommendations about the state's long-term care system or lack of a system, I'd sure appreciate knowing what those recommendations are. Thank you very much.
Jim, you were going to respond or have a comment?
Yes, briefly. In this governor's commission, one of the statements that was made on page one, as a matter of fact, in the state of Alaska, one of the findings is, nevertheless, health care still only accounts for about 4% of all state and local government spending in Alaska, compared to the average in all other states, average of 12%. And I think maybe some of it is coming into the realization that as a percent of gross national product nationwide, the health care is in the double digits. And in Alaska, it hasn't arrived there yet. So I don't know. I guess it's becoming aware of that.
Mark, I know you want to close, but I'm just so curious. You made another statement about people need to prepare for their futures. And at $500,000 a year to generate the cost of, I mean, you'd have to have $500,000 on deposit minimum, I would think, to generate the return necessary to pay for long-term care. Do you have any other recommendations other than for those folks who don't think they can save $500,000?
Well, I think the legislature made a step forward.
I'm not
but
being
I,
facetious,
I know.
By the way.
I think the legislature made it. Legislature last year, or was it the year before, made a significant step forward when it enacted legislation that spoke about a living will, that people need to make choices and they need to clearly do that so that they let their children and the helping professions know that's part of the equation. That's a minor part of it, but part of it. We're labor intensive to deliver the service, and I don't know how we avoid that. We have to support more community-based services, Mark, and certainly the chairman have led the cause for that. We've got before being in long-term care, I was in a senior center for 18 years, and we developed good working relationships, and I think we had a workable system that helped avoid institutionalization. And I've counseled with individuals about persons who have persons who have cancer and said, do you want treatment? You know, and the common wisdom was, yes, go for whatever it was. But when you sit down and look at it in the light of day and speak about that, some people choose not to do it. And they avoid those expensive bills. And they make that personal choice. I think we have to do more education of our population as to what some of these choices are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis, and thanks, Jim. We can now just kind of shift here a little bit and ask Dr. Bruce Amundson to join us.
Get this about 6 inches from me.
Thank you.
I'll hear it on the other side.
My name is Bruce Amundson, and I'm with the School of Medicine in Seattle. And for the past, medical school has a significant history in working with problems in our region, but for the past 3 to 4 years, we've been involved with a sample of communities in the Northwest trying to look at the issues in rural health care and what kind of more creative approaches might be taken to help rural communities that are struggling with many of the issues that I think you know very well. I was interested to note in the governor's commission that one of the principles guiding the recommendations was to enhance the community responsibility for health care. And that's where our focus has really been, and what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is share with you some of our findings and experience from assisting communities to be able to be more responsible for sustaining their health services, but also some more recent information on financing those services, and perhaps even some approaches to utilization and cost containment that at least are of real interest to us. In the course of our work, we've looked in a very systematic and exhaustive way at the issues, the problems that typical communities in the Northwest are facing, rural communities. And the data has really been quite sobering, that you're aware of many of the issues facing rural healthcare, but when we actually got down to looking in collaboration with the healthcare leaders and the community leaders in the sample of rural communities, the number of issues, the number of problems that a typical community was grappling with at the same time was extremely sobering, and it didn't surprise us why many of our rural health professionals and administrators and trustees and so forth were feeling really exhausted and burned out by the kind of environment that they're working in. And it's been helpful for us to divide those problems into a couple of categories. First, the issues that are sort of external to the community, the issues that I think you'd be dealing with a good deal in the legislature. The declining economic base in rural communities and what impact that has to sustain services, shifting population trends. But in the health field, decreasing reimbursement rates in the public sector, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance reimbursement for providers, the policy, the regulatory environment within which communities work. These are issues that are having a significant impact, and I think you're already hearing more about that this morning. But to a large degree, those are issues that rural communities have relatively little, individual communities at least, have relatively little ability to impact. They operate within that environment, but there's a limited amount that they can do to gain some kind of help and relief. And we've then looked more pointedly at the internal issues, the issues within communities, that that communities do in fact have some greater ability to address. Examples of those would be issues of manpower, nurses, physicians, other health technicians, the manpower issues, issues of quality, issues of the skills and confidence of trustees and governors of hospitals and nursing homes in a very changing environment, the issues of the financial management, financial systems and management systems within rural institutions. And another example that I'll dwell on for just a minute is the outmigration of rural residents for care. Those of us that have been in rural communities, and I practiced in a rural community for about 9 years, have been aware for a long time that a lot of rural residents leave rural communities for health services. But we haven't understood that very well. And as we try to document that more explicitly, the out-migration for care is, in fact, in many, if not most, rural communities, huge for hospitalization, for physician services, for dental services, mental health, and so forth. And when we've tried to understand that, it's clear that a lot of people are leaving for care that can appropriately be provided in rural communities. But those of us in the rural communities have not done a very effective job of understanding why people were leaving and trying to address the issues of confidence, the issues of quality, whatever those reasons are. And I could spend quite a lot of time talking about those reasons. We understand them quite clearly. Just last week, we got information back on another 8 communities in Idaho and Washington, all rural communities, all of the size that you might experience in Alaska. And no community, none of those 8, had captured more than 40% of the admissions to the community hospital when that study was done. Well, clearly that has an impact on sustaining and supporting financially the viability of services in rural communities. And yet nobody's going to solve that but communities themselves. And so we've been working real hard to try to look at how that issue, those issues that are involved in out-migration, for example, can be addressed more effectively, because clearly it relates very directly to the financial issues that you're hearing a good deal about. Well, the good news is that when communities have, and we've developed along in collaboration with these communities, sort of a systematic and community-wide approach to identifying these problems, to aggressively addressing them, to developing a plan for a community. What should a rural community be providing in terms of a scope of care? What can it afford? What can it be provided in a quality manner? And then in a very systematic and effective way, trying to address those issues and institute that scope of health services with careful attention to quality and affordability. And the good news is, as I suggested, that when this has happened in every community that we've seen utilize this kind of systematic approach, the results, the effect of really very effectively addressing these intra-community issues has been most impressive to those of us at the University of Washington. In the handout that I gave you, there's a page that lists the kind of examples of the types of things that small communities have done to some of the outcomes to strengthen and sustain, and I might add in many cases really expand the scope of health services in communities where over the years that scope had been constricting. If you look at that roster, you'll notice that most of those are very major outcomes. Successful recruitment, increasing the financial solvency of hospitals, increasing the quality of care, governance training, new financial systems, new health insurance schemes, and so forth. They are not tampering. They're not little kinds of adjustments. They're major strategic initiatives to try to strengthen local care. I'm not suggesting that there won't be continuing problems in these communities, because there are some issues.